You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko otu toku ingoa. Nau mai hare mai ki te Wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Ra Apa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by producers Max and Manny. E whai aki nei, coming up on the show, for our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, I spoke with MP Ricardo Menendez March about Winston Peters' refusal to recognize Palestine at the UN General Assembly, and the government's decision to reopen applications for oil and gas exploration across Aotearoa. And I speak with Hiba Mortaja from Aotearoa for Palestine for a follow-up conversation about Winston Peters' decision not to recognize Palestine at the UN and the upcoming March for Humanity on the Auckland Harbour Bridge they've announced in response. Max, what have you got for us today?
I speak to co-chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, John Minto, to discuss the Gaza peace proposal suggested by US President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday at the White House. And we'll be speaking to retired professor in international relations Stephen Hoadley on this topic as well.
And Manny, what have you got for us today?
I speak to Associate Professor George Laking on the government's amendments to change the purpose, objectives and function of Paola legislation of Health New Zealand.
Hey, aha o whakaro. I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai, text in on 5395, or waia mai rane, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua, e ware ware e ahe ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kuarero anō, he pakihere roki roki marunga i te pai, tukutuku o irirangi pōho, me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
While speaking at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly over the weekend, Foreign Minister Winston Peters announced that New Zealand would not be recognizing a Palestinian state at this point in time. Peters' rationale was that Hamas's leadership in Gaza would make recognizing Palestine an unwise move for New Zealand, additionally stating that it could trigger a reaction from Israel that would lead to more aggressive policies in both Gaza and the West Bank. However, with more than 40% of New Zealand public expressing support for Palestinian recognition and for stronger action to be taken against Israel for their actions in Gaza, which the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territories has referred to as a genocide, this decision by Peters has been the subject of widespread controversy amongst activists, experts, and a large portion of the general public. Additionally, despite claiming to take a more balanced and calculated approach to Israel's genocide in Gaza, Winston Peters' decision at the UN General Assembly has placed New Zealand amongst a small handful of Western nations that have refused to recognize Palestine, with the United Kingdom, France, Canada, and our close ally Australia all announcing their recognition of Palestine shortly before. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, we speak to him about Foreign Minister Winston Peters' decision not to recognize Palestine at the UN General Assembly. We also spoke to him about the government's decision last week to resume oil and gas exploration across Aotearoa. To begin, what was the Green Party's reaction to Winston Peters' announcement that New Zealand would not be recognizing a Palestinian state at the UN General Assembly?
Not only is Winston Peters factually incorrect when he's making those statements, it's morally repugnant that we are choosing to effectively, rather than genuinely pursuing an independent foreign policy based on values of justice, of being against genocides, of peace, to effectively take sides with the US, who is facilitating and enabling this genocide. There's nothing independent about the position that we have taken. If anything, it simply enables Israel and facilitates the US's involvement in this horrible, horrible genocide that we are witnessing. It's a real shame that we are in the wrong side of history and in this point of time.
So just going off of that, there are claims that Peter's decision to not recognize Palestine was to prioritize trade relations with the United States. Do you think that this is a more likely reason for Peter's decision?
Well, we are kowtowing to the U.S., and it's a real shame that the government is choosing to take this uncritical approach to Palestinian statehood recognition, because siding with the US is not even getting us at any economic gains. We're being continuously slapped with tariffs, and independent of our relationship with the US, we should be taking foreign positions that that are grounded on values of justice, peace, and recognizing the dignity that Palestinians inherently have. The recognition of Palestinian statehood is something we could do on top of introducing things like sanctions and joining the ICJ case as well.
Additionally, what do you make of Peter's justification that Hamas's involvement in Gaza invalidates the legitimacy of a Palestinian state? Do you think that there's a valid reason for the government to not recognize Palestine on this basis?
Absolutely not, because at the end of the day, what we are doing is taking away the ability for Palestinians to make decisions on what sovereignty looks like and what the future of their nation looks like. So long as we continue not recognizing Palestinian statehood here, it makes that level of diplomacy and work towards Palestinian sovereignty a lot harder. And all that we are doing is enabling Israel's position, which is that they do not support a two-state solution. The government has made that incredibly clear. And one of the few ways that we can push against that is by having a clear majority of the world, which is now where we're at, excluding New Zealand, the United States, and a handful of nations, recognizing Palestinian statehood. That in and of itself puts pressure on Israel to work towards a genuine solution that does grant Palestinians a sovereignty that they deserve.
Additionally, a recent RNZ Reed research poll found that more than 40% of New Zealanders, who made up the largest block of respondents, supported Palestinian recognition and wanted stronger action to be taken against Israel for their actions in Gaza. Do you think that Peter's announcement goes against the wishes of the New Zealand general public?
Peter's announcements makes me worry that Luxon, Peters, and Seymour would have been in support of things like South Africa's apartheid back in the day if they had been in government, because they're clearly out of touch with the general public, who I believe overall support genuine work towards peace and justice, Palestinian statehood, and the prevention of genocide, which we saw just a couple of weeks ago, how tens of thousands of people marched throughout our biggest city demanding sanctions on Israel. And I do think that the government is finding themselves not just on the wrong side of history and the wrong side of, you know, where the international place is at, as well as the wrong side with the public, who I do believe would be largely against genocides occurring anywhere in the world.
Earlier, you mentioned that Peter's decision places New Zealand among a handful of countries that have chosen not to recognize Palestine. What impacts do you think that Peter's decision will have on New Zealand's reputation on the global stage?
What Winston Peters, Luxon, and Seymour are doing is placing New Zealand in a position where we are no longer going to be seen as paragons of international law, of having a strong diplomatic presence in the international stage and movements towards peace and justice. And instead, we're simply going to be seen as a nation that bows to the U.S. on the international stage, even when the U.S. is clearly disregarding international law, when the U.S. is clearly complicit in facilitating this genocide. And it tarnishes our reputation as a country that can be relied upon for strong diplomatic actions against genocides.
And what actions will the Green Party be taking in response to the government's decision not to recognize Palestine?
Our co-leader, Chloe Sorbick, has already taken action and gotten in touch with members of parliament asking them to support sanctions on Israel. But we're making it incredibly clear that we're seeking to change this government to be able to introduce sanctions on Israel, as well as introduce a recognition of Palestinian statehood as soon as we're able to get into government. All of these issues, including genocide in Gaza, the cost of living crisis and the climate crisis, are completely intertwined, because at the end of the day, it's the same system that takes away our humanity that is allowing poverty to be rife in Aotearoa and that does not see the inherent humanity of Palestinian peoples.
All right, moving on to the next topic. The government recently reopened applications for oil and gas exploration across the whole of Aotearoa for the first time since the practice was banned in 2018. As of last Thursday, companies are now able to apply for new exploration permits anywhere across the Motu, with Resources Minister Shane Jones additionally saying that a new open market would create simpler application tests and fewer reporting requirements for applicants. So next, I'd like to ask, what was the Green Party Saudi's reaction to the government's decision to reopen oil and gas exploration here in Aotearoa?
It's straight up farcical. Not only is it poor economic management, because at the end of the day, oil and gas are not where the future of the energy sector is at. And it also takes more than a decade often for these companies to be able to go from exploration all the way to production. So we're not going to be seeing any so-called gains for quite some time. And it turns us away from meeting our climate commitments and then taking meaningful action to lower electricity bills. The government could instead be investing in renewable sources of energy and solarizing and putting solar panels on our homes, on our buildings, to lower electricity costs and create a much more resilient energy sector. And then tackling gentailers who are making humongous profits at the expense of everyday people. And this government just seems to be giving them a free pass when it comes to the fact that they're one of the reasons why energy bills are high, because they instead would rather pass those profits to shareholders as opposed to reduce electricity costs.
New Zealand was commended for the ban on oil and gas exploration in 2018 as a show of climate leadership. How do you think that the commencement of exploration will impact New Zealand's global reputation?
Well, it means that as a nation, we won't be taken seriously when it comes to climate issues. And in the Pacific, this does matter because climate change isn't some abstract issue. It's a matter of survival for many communities. And even in cities like Auckland, we have seen what extreme weather events can cause when we have floodings like the ones we had at the beginning of 2023, which saw homes being completely wiped out, even, you know, in the neighborhood that I live in. Now there's a lot of empty lots of houses that are having to be ripped away. And so we've got to remember that all of these actions that we take towards a climate-safe future is also about addressing the cost of living crisis, about giving communities the guarantee that they won't be displaced due to issues like flooding. And this is why it's concerning that the government not only seems to be turning their backs away from our climate commitments, but also not investing on the renewable energy and climate resilient infrastructure to protect us from events like flooding.
Do you think this decision is less about securing energy, as the government has said, or more about securing the government's relationship with lobbyists and donors from the fossil fuel industry?
We have seen the government completely taking sides with the fossil fuel industry to the point of giving them hundreds of millions of dollars worth of subsidies. You know, and when we couple that with the $3 billion that they have given to landlords, it really puts the question of who is this government ruling for? It clearly isn't for the majority of people, but it is ruling for a handful of CEOs who are creaming it at a time of a cost of living crisis. What is worse as well is that the fossil fuel CEOs won't be delivering genuine cost of living relief for people in this country, because we won't even be seeing the benefits of the so-called exploration for quite some time. And at the same time, we're not seeing the government putting investments in issues like renewable to the degree that we need to lower energy bills.
And that was Green Party MP Ricardo Menendez-March talking to us about Winston Peter's refusal to recognize Palestine at the UN General Assembly and the government's decision to reopen applications for oil and gas exploration across Aotearoa.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Following our previous conversation with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, we spoke with Hiba Mortaja from Aotearoa for Palestine for a follow-up conversation about Foreign Minister Winston Peter's decision not to recognize Palestine at the UN General Assembly. Aotearoa for Palestine have condemned Winston Peter's announcement, saying that it is indicative of the government's complicity in Israel's genocide in Gaza, and that the upcoming march across the Auckland Harbour Bridge will have its details announced soon. Here is that interview with Hiba Mortaja from Aotearoa for Palestine. To begin, what was your reaction to Winston Peter's announcement that New Zealand would not be recognizing a Palestinian state?
Yeah, I mean, as a Palestinian from Gaza, I'm very disappointed and outraged, you know, at the New Zealand government's decision at the UN General Assembly. I think, you know, this decision doesn't really reflect, like, New Zealand values and the strong public support for Palestine. I think this was also demonstrated, like, several weeks ago, where there were up to, like, 50,000 people in Tamaki Makaurau that were protesting to impose sanctions on Israel. And I think recognizing the state of Palestine would have been a step forward towards ensuring Palestinian self-determination. Yeah, and the New Zealand government indicating that they won't recognize Palestine until there is peace is contradicting, as they only recognize the side that's committing a genocide.
Was this an outcome that you were expecting, or were you hopeful that Winston Peters might actually recognize a Palestinian state at the UN?
part of me was a little bit hopeful, but at the same time, you know, we have been protesting nationwide in Aotearoa, New Zealand for Palestine. And, you know, this government hasn't really done much to support Palestine or show any kind of solidarity for Palestine. So it wasn't a complete shock.
What kind of a message do you think this sends to both Palestinians in Aotearoa and abroad, as well as other people in Aotearoa that have been showing solidarity with Palestine?
It just shows that, you know, the government isn't listening to us. You know, we've been protesting for 2 years, a genocide that's been happening in Gaza and also escalating violence in the West Bank. And it just shows that the government doesn't really listen to the people, especially with, you know, the most recent protest that we had. Up to 50,000 people have come to social solidarity for Palestine, and that just felt like it fell on deaf ears.
Many Palestinians have been calling for steps beyond just recognizing Palestine, such as sanctions and embargoes to be put on Israel for its actions in Gaza. Does Winston Peters' announcement make you less hopeful about that happening as well?
Unfortunately, yes. You know, our main demand for the New Zealand government is to impose sanctions on Israel for committing war crimes, for committing genocide. And it did make us feel less hopeful. I think recognizing Palestine is the least that they could have done. And showing that they couldn't even recognize Palestine is so disappointing. And not just disappointing, but it's also, it makes us feel really angry that there's all this support happening nationwide, yet nothing kind of coming out of that.
Winston Peters has also said that his decision comes from the New Zealand government adopting a, quote, independent and neutral foreign policy approach. Do you think that this is true, or do you think there are other factors motivating the government's decision not to recognize Palestine at the UN?
I think there are other factors. I think one of the things that Winston Peters mentioned in his speech was that there would have been escalating violence recognizing Palestine. However, it's almost like siding with those that are, you know, committing a genocide. It is actually showing that, you know, that the fact that they are freely recognizing Israel, whereas they didn't want to recognize Palestine, just kind of goes against that. It's not a neutral stance. It's actually a stance that's supporting, you know, those that are committing a genocide.
There have also been claims that Peter's decision not to recognize Palestine was to prioritize trade relations with the United States and out of fear of repercussions from the United States. Do you think that this is a more likely reason for Peter's decision?
Yes, I think that is the most likely reason. I mean, the U.S. funding this genocide, and so I do think it might be that. However, I think that it's quite disappointing coming from New Zealand when it has stood up for, you know, human rights and has shown, you know, solidarity for those that are experiencing injustice, like years ago when we protested the Springbok tours. But why is Palestine different? That's what's disappointing.
As part of Aotearoa for Palestine's condemnation of Winston Peters' announcement and decision, your group has announced the Auckland Harbour Bridge protest to call for sanctions and to show solidarity with Palestine. Can you give us some details about this march, when it will be happening, and how our listeners can get involved in it?
Yeah, so just please keep an eye out on our socials, Aotearoa for Palestine, on Instagram. You know, our government has failed us. We're coming up to 2 years of genocide in Gaza and escalating violence in the West Bank. So we do have a protest. We do have a protest actually coming up on the 4th of October in Aotea Square, and also the March for Humanity on the Auckland Harbour Bridge. So we will be announcing it soon. We don't have the date posted yet, but we will be announcing it soon on the page for at Aotearoa for Palestine. If you would like to help, it would be great. We are looking for volunteers to be a kaiapina. You could also volunteer just to keep our people safe while we're marching. It is going to be safe. We do try to ensure, you know, safety for everyone. So if you'd like to volunteer to be kaiapina, we've got our email kaiapinaaotearoa@gmail.com.
And leading up to and after the march, is there anything that New Zealanders can do to show solidarity with Palestine and to put pressure on the government to take stronger action against Israel for its actions in Gaza?
Yeah, so like we've said, you know, our government has failed us, and so we need to pressure our government. We do have, other than the march on the Harbour Bridge, we do have weekly protests happening in Tamaki Makaurau and nationwide. So you could follow Aotearoa for Palestine just for some updates on that. Also, boycott Israeli products. This is a long-term solution to protest the illegal occupation of Palestine, support businesses that stand up against genocide. We also still have our petition up, so you can sign our petition to sanction Israel for committing war crimes, and that is on our action station, and it's NZ government sanction Israel now.
And that was Hiba Mortaja from Aotearoa for Palestine speaking to us about Winston Peters' decision not to recognize Palestine at the United Nations, as well as the upcoming March for Humanity across the Auckland Harbour Bridge. We'll be back after a quick break. Keep it on the B. 95 BFM.
We'll be right back. music store in Newmarket is Aotearoa's newest destination for vintage and pre-loved music gear.
With Go Cooler, you can save money on your music setup without skimping on quality. Plus, students get a 10% discount. Go Cooler have a wide range of sick equipment from Squires, Yamahas, Epiphones, LTDs, and more.
Go Cooler Music is open Wednesday till Sunday, 10 till 4. Find Go Cooler Music on Facebook, spelled G-O-K-U-L-A. Go Cooler Music Store, 378 Broadway, Newmarket.
Jazz Cigarette, Bob Hope, Dubage, Jar Rastafari, Wacky Backy, Mez, Mary Jane, Marley, Sheba Cheba.
Whatever you call it,
Muggles.
Marijuana Media has you covered. Every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, join Chris Fowley from Normal for the good word on law reform, cannabis in the media, and the latest in green science. Marijuana Media, 4:20 every Thursday on 95BFM Drive, thanks to The Hemp Store. Visit them at 253 K Road or shop online at hempstore.co.nz.
Wow, we get along so well. I feel like I've known you my whole life.
I know, it's crazy. I'd love to see you again.
Sorry, I just have to ask. Your hoodie is so random. What is 95BFM?
Oh, I knew this was too good to be true.
What? Wait, where are you going?
No!
Show the world exactly who you are with our range of classic 95BFM merch. From the BSA slogan t-shirt to ringer tees and hoodies, get yours now at twotonesmerch.co.nz.
West Coast, chopping.
Regan, wake
East
up.
West Coast.
Honey,
onshore.
You're having those strange nightmares. Oh, no, it's not.
One out of ten on both coasts.
Oh, God. Father Damien, it's happening again.
Looking for tubular swells? It's the 95BFM Surf Report. Is the West Coast gnarly? Is the East Coast bogus? Do people even still use these words? Find out every morning on Breakfast and every afternoon on Drive. The Totally Radical Surf Report, proudly brought to you by the dudes and dudettes at ProGear.
I don't kiss men.
The Wire.
But I kissed him.
Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Let us know your thoughts on any of these pieces today. Text in on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was greeted by United States President Donald Trump at the White House to discuss many things, including ending the war in Gaza. After a lengthy talk, the leaders announced to the press the conditions they had come up with to offer to Hamas, despite no Palestinian or Hamas officials being present. The proposal calls for an immediate ceasefire, a swap of hostages held by Hamas and prisoners held by Israel, a staged Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian territory, and demands that Hamas immediately disarms and renounces any governance in the Strip. The US president's plan would also establish a temporary governing board that would be headed by Trump himself and would include former United Kingdom Prime Minister Tony Blair. Trump then announced Hamas had 3 or 4 days to respond to the deal, and Netanyahu promised that if Hamas were to reject the deal, he would, quote, finish the job in Gaza. To talk about the peace proposal led by Donald Trump, and if it brings the war in Gaza any closer to ending, I spoke to co-chair of the Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa, John Minto.
Firstly, what did you make of the conditions of the peace deal?
Well, I think the conditions which they've put forward are simply asking for the complete capitulation of Hamas. And the reason they're asking for that is that Hamas is putting up absolutely fierce resistance to the Israeli troops invading Gaza. And they want that to end. Israel wants this to end because it's going to be far too costly for them. And I think the international public opinion is so strongly in favour of Palestine that the US government now realises it's causing it huge problems by continuing to support Israel the way it is.
And do you see this peace deal as a step towards peace in Gaza?
No, it isn't. It's not a step towards peace at all. It's simply a recolonisation of Palestine, organised by the US. So, you know, you've got all these colonial powers meeting together to decide what happens in Palestine, and no one is talking to the Palestinian people. This plan was developed without any Palestinian consultation whatever. So it's very much a colonial mindset which the US is in. and it's one that will not bring peace or justice for Palestinians.
What does it say about the legitimacy of the peace deal that Hamas was not invited and had reportedly not received the deal when it was announced yesterday?
Well, it's just quite deliberately an attempt to force Hamas into a corner and give them a whole series of ultimatums. But I think in that sense, it shows, in a sense, how weak the proposal from Trump is, because he doesn't have buy-in. This is an enormous attempt to sort of overshadow and overpower Hamas diplomatically and politically, to force it to sign up to a really egregious set of conditions. So we'll see what the reaction of Hamas is, and it'll be interesting to see how things go forward.
Is it realistic for Hamas to accept a peace deal that demands they immediately disarm and renounce any governance in Gaza?
Well, I think Hamas has said it several times in the last several years, in fact, that they don't necessarily see themselves as being in sort of a governorship role in Gaza. They see themselves as part of the armed resistance to Israeli occupation and apartheid and ethnic cleansing. They don't necessarily see themselves as a role, having a role in the ongoing governorship of Gaza. So just where Hamas sees things at the moment, I'm not sure that will be over to them. But yeah, that aspect of the deal was never going to be a deal breaker.
Many Palestinians have been reported to feel sceptical about the deal. Do you think it's reasonable for them to feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. Palestinians will be completely sceptical. This is a deal put together by Trump on behalf of several billionaires who are going to massively profit from this rebuilding effort in Gaza. It is something that's not there for the Palestinian people in any sense at all. And we've got just strong-arm tactics by a whole cabal of horrible people lined up against Palestinians. And by that I mean El-Sisi, the president or prime minister of Egypt, someone who stands with Israel rather than with Palestinians. You've got Mohammed bin Salman, who's basically an Arab despot in the region. You've got Jared Kushner, Trump's son-in-law. So you've got and Tony Blair, the person who was part of that triumvirate of countries which invaded Iraq. So I think we've got a real horrible group of people together here trying to make the most money they can out of this continuing occupation of Gaza.
Netanyahu has promised that if Hamas doesn't accept the peace deal, he will, quote, finish the job in Gaza, and will reportedly have US permission to do so. Does that align with someone who would want peace in the region?
No, it doesn't. This is, in a sense, there's a slight amount of desperation here in what the US is doing, because it knows that the political damage that's being done to the US around the world is absolutely enormous. The US and Western countries in general, New Zealand in particular, have lost any moral authority to speak on any international issue. They're continuing a process of condemning any groups that are fighting anti-colonial struggles, such as the Palestinians, and they want to maintain Western dominance over the entire world. And Trump, the damage being done to Trump now and to the US is so bad that they really do want, they do want to see it finish, but they want to see it finish on their terms with huge economic opportunities from the area of the Gaza Strip.
And in an ideal situation, what does a peace deal actually look like in Gaza?
Well, a peace deal in Gaza would look like a timetable set for Israel to abide by international law and United Nations resolutions. And if that happened, we would have peace and justice in the Middle East without any problem at all, provided the world insists that Israel follow that process. We do not need negotiations. The framework is there. It's been there for 77 years. Palestinians simply need international law and United Nations resolutions to be upheld by everyone in the world, and force that onto Israel. It would mean the end of Israel's military occupation. It would mean equal rights for all Palestinians living in historic Palestine, and it would mean the right of return of Palestinian refugees to their land and homes from which they've been expelled by the Israeli military.
That was PSNA co-chair John Minto on the Gaza peace proposal suggested by US President Donald Trump and why Palestinians should be involved in the governance of Gaza.
The government has indicated a progress.
The Wire.
Retired Professor in International Relations Stephen Hoadley is joining us live to discuss this peace proposal. Hi, Stephen, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Is this Otto?
This is Max from 95BFM. How are you today, Stephen?
Hello, I'm good, Max. Looking forward to having a chat.
Stephen, John Minto stated that this proposal is not a step towards peace in Gaza. Would you agree with that statement?
No, I'm afraid John and I are on opposite sides of the political spectrum. I listened to his final remarks, and essentially he's saying Israel should not exist. Israel has no basis in fact or law that the Palestinians own all of that land, and that there's no place for Jews or the Israeli state. So I think it's going to be hard to find common ground between us.
Would you say that the conditions of this peace deal are reasonable for Palestinians or for Hamas?
Yeah, well, I like the peace deal. It is no different to what the Israelis have been asking for the last 2 years since the massacre in October the 7th. It is simply the removal of Hamas military capability, its governance of the Gaza Strip, a reform of the Palestinian Authority to have elections and the end of corruption and the end of payments to terrorists and the end of denial of Israeli statehood. The 20-point statement is an elaboration of these fundamental requests by Israel with a couple of new wrinkles, such as the creation of a board of peace, some kind of international security force, and a few other details. But aside from that, it really doesn't bring anything new, except Trump has imposed a 72-hour deadline. And that it does force the issue a little more pointedly. And now the ball is in Hamas court to respond.
What do you make of Benjamin Netanyahu promising to, quote, finish the job in Gaza if Hamas were to reject this peace deal?
I think it's simply a statement of the obvious that Israel is continuing its military offensive in Gaza City as we speak. The ceasefire is conditional on Hamas responding. And as I just looked at the news, Hamas has not yet responded. As soon as Hamas responds favorably, the offensive will stop and there will be a ceasefire in place in Gaza. So Hamas rejects the conditions, and these are conditions that have been put forward in previous peace proposals, Hamas has rejected them or modified them or in some way evaded them. If they does that, which I think is highly likely, then Israel will continue its military offensive until it captures the entirety of Gaza City and it captures, neutralizes, or imprisons or expels those Gazans who are militants, who are carrying weapons, who are supporting Hamas. And that process will continue to its bitter end. And there will be controversy. There'll be outcries about innocent civilians being killed. There will be the usual condemnation of Israel. But it is Israel that is in control. Israel has the military capability. Israel is the neighbor to Gaza. No one else is closer to Gaza than Israel is. And Israel will continue, regardless of public opinion, votes in the United Nations, and other kinds of media criticism.
Do you think that foreign leaders like Donald Trump should play a role in the governance of Hamas if there were to be a peace deal?
No, I don't think Donald Trump. I think he's exactly the wrong person. He just wants to develop Gaza as a real estate opportunity. Tony Blair has a very shadowed reputation as a warmonger in Iraq and now a billionaire slumlord in London. I think that is really flawed. But the basic idea of having an international security force with Arab countries, with the cooperation of the Israelis, so the Arabs would gradually replace the Israel Defense Force in a graduated step-by-step process. I think this is sound. Now, they'll train up a Palestinian police according to the peace plan. The Palestinian police will be not Hamas. They'll be neutral. They will keep order, help with the process of disarmament, and eventually become the backbone of security in a new Gazan state, which will become part of a new Palestinian state. So aside from a few hardliners in Israel, nobody is rejecting the idea of an eventual Palestinian state. And that includes the New Zealand government and a half a dozen other governments as well. It is just that the conditions for peace have to be in place before the recognition of a Palestinian state. So it's a matter of sequencing of incremental steps to maximize security, minimize violence, and to provide a roadmap to a desired ending.
All right, Stephen, that's all we have time for today. Thanks for coming on the show to talk about this.
Sorry. Sorry to interrupt you, Max. I was just, this is Otto again. I was just wondering if I could possibly ask a question as well.
Sure. Go ahead.
Well, so throughout the past 2 years, there's been a number of occasions where fighting in Gaza and Israel's military operations in Gaza have resumed after ceasefire deals have been achieved. Do you think that should Hamas agree to this deal, that it could truly mark an end to the war in Gaza and that Palestinians in Gaza can rest assured, can rest assured knowing that the fighting will stop?
Yes, if the conditions of the 20-point peace plan are accepted by Hamas, Hamas gives up its weapons, those members can accept an amnesty, which is now being offered, or they can exile. They can go to Iran or Turkey or wherever it will receive them and get safe passage out of Gaza. And I have no doubt that the Israeli government will follow through. Yes, there's some hotheads, Smotrich and Ben-Gavir in the cabinet. Look, they can be sidelined. They're only two out of a cabinet of 20. That cabinet may fall. There may be new elections in Israel. I have no doubt that Israel is by and large a law-abiding country, that if Hamas keeps its side of the deal, Israel will keep its side of the deal, and there can be peace in the Middle East.
All right, thanks for coming on the show today to talk about this, Stephen. We really appreciate it.
Okay, you're welcome. Anytime.
That was retired professor in international relations Stephen Hoadley on the Gaza peace proposal suggested by U.S. President Donald Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday at the White House. We'll be right back after a short break.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials, because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner, because the revolution will not be televised, brother.
There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run, or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Keyes, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with Coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Feeling like Coopy in that Walker boat. Feeling wavy through the shocker. Navigating bumpy shade through Walker. And blowing mad rupees with my brothers. It as the crew, knew we ought to walk up. I hang the boots up, still goose step you busters. Nah, I ride a pack of zoo, loosely with a lover. And while I pass the cooch, who we undercover's my bow. I'm feeling like I'm Hongi Hika in that suit of armor. Lover, lover, socks and some new Havanas. I'm thumbing through my stock list. Portobello shrooms, little butter with shallots and some garlic. Undisturbed pop for my darling. Then hopped in the whip. Picked the tune, hit the bro shop. Bought a jarring. Wholesale for the bro shop, for the bargain. Shaw said the bar set shop in the bathroom. We used to. Not a role model, not Pac, I'm not Biggie. I'm not Fat Freddy's drop, I'm not Ticky. Shout out my cousin, I love him, but I'm not 660. I once sold a dude a gram of for 650. And yo, the shit was split 50. Hey yo, the shit was split 50. Digi's, scales in a bag, I got busy. Fuck all of that, I got kids, G. Word to Elisha and Shiraz, it got risky. Still put the flame to the can, I'm not picky. Out of Southeast Asia with Tang, I got frisky. Chill, put your face in your hands, get rocked swiftly. Chill, ride a blaze on the sand, get hard sticky. Young and sitting licks like Tixie. Up and down the field like Fitzy. Cooper in that walker. Feeling wavy through the shocker. Navigating bumpy shade food walker. And blowing mad rupees with my brothers. And that's the crew, knew we oughta walk. I hang the boots up, still goose step you busters. I ride a pack of zoo, loosely with a lover. And while I patch the cooch, who we undercover's my boat. I'm from Kaikohe, descendant of Hongi Hika. Home of the thick again, throw him out the double dicker. Peep the veins, bitch, my bloodline, royal boat. Saw more moldy roots, straight from the soil boat. Yeah, by muscle to Vitalor. The Oratars used to mix cover after the war. Long line of navigators who love to explore. But if you double cross me, then the Sibella will slash your jaw. My thoughts dirty like Manu. Fly like a Manu, put my enemies in tunnels. Fuck your sovereignty. I got G's that hold straps with sovereign rings. You can say this colonized, look in my eyes, can tell I'm king.
bitch. I got the mahi in the kitchen. Distribute the girls from the knocker to Waiheke. It's still fifty. Fuck the system, tell them get fit. They say they got dough, then get rolled like punna kick it.
Where the fuck you from?
Ko puta he te monga. Ko o mapere te roto, ko wairoro te awa.
Ko te nomege ke he matakoa.
I'm a spirited indigenous, this music is my thonga, so I can spread all the power.
Feeling like Koopa and that waka. Feeling wavy through the shaka. Navigating bumping shade food waka. And blowing mad rupees with my brothers. It asked the crew, knew we all the walker. I hang the boost up, still boost step you busters. I brought a pack of zoot loosely with a lover. And while I pass the cooch, who we undercover's my boat.
From hiring freezers to canning te aka whaiora, we've seen significant shake-ups of our public health system under this current government. And now Minister for Health Simeon Brown has put forward further reforms to Health New Zealand to change the public health services purpose, objectives and functions. I spoke to Associate Professor George Laking over their concerns that the removal of preventative care will degrade the foundations of our health system.
This amendment that we're talking about applies to the Peora Healthy Futures Act. This act was first established 3 years ago. Could you tell us about the context that this amendment is coming in?
So it's just part of a larger scheme of the government to roll back a lot of the legislation that have been put in place by the previous government and really to roll it back without any adequate replacement for a lot of the positive measures that were in the previous legislation. We've been especially concerned about the removal of provisions for preventative health that were part of the original Te Pae Ora Healthy Futures Act.
Right, and could you give us some examples of these provisions?
Yeah, I think most people would agree that in matters of health, it's far better to prevent things from going wrong with people's health rather than waiting for them to become unwell and try to patch them up. And there's all sorts of things essentially about the lifestyle that we live or we're encouraged to live that actually work against good health. But that especially relates to our diet and our physical activity and various addictions that are around in society. All those things, if you could do something about those, you could actually massively improve people's health overall. And that would take a lot of pressure off the part of the health system that provides health care. But the Amendment Act is completely blind to this. It identifies the health system as purely being about providing care when something's gone wrong. I mean, we need that, of course. But if your health system is only there to provide care when things go wrong, you don't do anything to prevent things going wrong, actually, your health system is going to crumble under the pressure of demand. It just won't be able to cope with problems that were entirely preventable but weren't prevented.
In contemporary practices in some parts of the world, there are more emphasis on preventative care, healthy activity and support to achieve this. But why do you feel that this is being rolled back? Do you buy the government's arguments?
Well, I don't, because, you know, one approach they might have taken would be to say, well, okay, we've got a part of our health system that provides care when people need it, but there's also a duty of the government to make sure that people are as healthy as possible in the first place. And they're just walking away from that duty of preventative health without any kind of replacement for that in the Te Pae Ora Healthy Futures Act. In general, what you find with what they call the determinants of health, the things that people do that you might not notice what it's doing at the time, but in the long term it is actually harmful to your health. In general, unfortunately, we find that those things are connected to someone's profit today. And I think that's the key to this. that if you're in an industry that pushes low levels of physical activity, that's like fossil fuels and motoring, unhealthy food, and if you look at the fast food industry and supermarkets there as well, or booze, then anything preventive that tries to move away from those lifestyles actually is going to eat into the profits of very profitable industries who happen to be friends with our government now. So it's not too surprising that our government would try to erase all that preventative stuff. Of course, people pay for this in terms of their lives and their happiness as individuals and as families. When a person falls ill, that's a tragedy and a catastrophe for a family, and doubly so if it was something that was preventable. But yeah, again, it's very sad our government decided it's that sort of prevention anymore. Previous National Minister of Health actually was. He was saying quite a bit about prevention, Shane Reti, Māori doctor, but they replaced him with another one who has a very simplistic idea of what the health system should be about, and he's wrong.
One of the ways that Simeon Brown is justifying these reforms is that it might increase efficiency and save money. What do you feel the monetary costs might actually be in the long run if we don't institute preventative care and support that?
Well, when I went to medical school years ago and we had a lecture on health economics, one of the first things that the professor said to us was, well, if you want to save money in health, it's very simple, you know, it's like shoot all the patients and shut all the hospitals. Financial efficiency isn't totally what health is supposed to be about. It's supposed to be about health and well-being of people. It's hard to see that you are going to have a financially efficient health system when it's overwhelmed and swamped by demand because of entirely preventable problems that you've chosen to ignore.
That was Associate Professor George Laking speaking on the dangers of degrading preventative care in the Healthy Futures Amendment Bill.
That was The Wire.
Ko I rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi ki a koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā. That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, Hiba Mortaja from Aotearoa for Palestine, Palestine Solidarity Network Aotearoa co-chair John Minto, retired Professor of International Relations at the University of Auckland, Stephen Hoadley, and Associate Professor of Oncology at the University of Auckland, George Laking. This is my last Wire ever, guys. I just wanted to say I've had such a great time hosting the Wednesday Wire and helping to bring news and current affairs on the airwaves at BFM. I want to give a shout out to my co-producers, Max and Manny. I want to give a shout out to news director Joel and the 95 BFM news team. I want to give a shout out to my mom for listening in whenever she does. Free Palestine and the genocide. Toi tu te tiriti, defend Māori tinuranga tiratanga and motuake. Take care of yourselves and get a B-card. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakurongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1 to 4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.